This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. We'll take a look at the big stories from around the region over the past week. Coming up, why a newspaper story prompted Vanuatu's Prime Minister to demand an apology from the UK government. In Papua New Guinea, a WhatsApp group is helping midwives in rural areas save lives. And Australia criticised for using aid money to bankroll a sports event in the face of competition from China. We'll have more on those stories coming up. Vanuatu's Prime Minister has defended efforts to clean up the country's controversial golden passport scheme after it sparked a diplomatic stoush with the British government. Ishmael Kalsikau's concerns centre on a UK newspaper article that claimed Chinese spies were using Vanuatu passports to gain visa-free entry to Britain. It comes in the middle of the United Kingdom's push to re-engage with the Pacific, so could this latest scandal damage diplomatic relations? Liam Fox reports.
Ishmael Kalsikau was not a happy man after reading a recent article in The Times newspaper. Not happy with the paper, but also unhappy with the British government.
They set up a high commission in Vanuatu, and I would have thought at least I would have been given notice of any concerns that they would have.
The article said Britain's domestic security agency, MI5, had warned UK ministers that Chinese spies are slipping into Britain by gaining citizenship through third countries and using their visa-free access to the UK. It singled out Vanuatu as one of those third countries, alongside Timor-Leste and Namibia. The article stated that the warning from MI5 had led the Home Office to prepare new visa restrictions for countries being exploited by China. Mr. Kalsikau says it was unfair and tarnished Vanuatu's international reputation.
We're trying our best to ensure that we have a transparent system and we have a rigid legal framework. We've passed some amendments in Parliament, and this sort of exposure doesn't help our cause at all.
It's not the first time Vanuatu's so-called golden passport scheme has been in the news. In recent years, several news organisations, including the ABC, have done stories on the country's lucrative citizenship by investment program, as it's formerly known. Those stories have documented how individuals with questionable backgrounds have purchased Vanuatu citizenship, and most importantly, a Vanuatu passport, all without even setting foot in the country. Mr. Kalsikau, though, says he has taken significant steps to clean up the scheme since becoming PM late last year, including a revamp of the body that oversees it, the Citizenship's Office and Commission.
So I've removed all the personnel replaced them with new personnel, and I've actually taken the Citizenship Act to Parliament by way of an amendment to ensure that we remove the probity checks away from the Citizenship Commission back to the Immigration Department separately, does its own check, followed by the police with Interpol.
He believes the Times article should have mentioned those measures and the British government should have briefed him on any concerns it has.
I believe we're running a government that has integrity. We're trying to ensure as much as possible that we don't let people who shouldn't be getting our citizenship in through the door, because it affects our reputation with other countries.
Tess Newton-Cain from Griffith University's Pacific Hub has dual British and Ni Vanuatu citizenship. She says the scheme is a sensitive issue for Mr. Kalsikau.
There's a lot of prickliness around that. I think that there are plenty in government that know that it's a vulnerability to an extent. They do take their international reputation very seriously, with good reason, as they should. And, yeah, I think it's obviously something that is, you know, gets under his skin and that he takes on quite a personal level.
In the wake of the article, Mr. Kalsikau demanded an apology from The Times and one from the British government. Both are unlikely to occur, though the British High Commissioner to Vanuatu, Nicolette Brent, met with the PM and gave him a traditional woven mat, one used in reconciliation ceremonies, according to the Daily Post newspaper. In a statement, Ms. Brent said,
We have been discussing concerns about the Citizenship by Investment Scheme with Vanuatu. We welcome the renewed focus by the government on reforming its CBI program, and we intend to continue the discussions in an open and honest way. We regret that the Times article was published in this way. We would never wish to see the reputation of our friend tarnished in this way, and I share in the embarrassment this article has caused.
Tess Newton-Cain says the High Commissioner's response was disappointing.
She kind of threw the Times under the bus. Yes, she needs to protect that relationship, but she also needs to remember that she's working in an environment where we've seen questions and issues about media freedom. We've seen government players try to shut the media down or make out that the media is irresponsible. And I think that as a major democratic power, representatives of the British government need to be ensuring that they walk the talk on issues like media freedom and an independent press.
All of this has occurred while Britain is attempting to recharge diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The reopening of the British High Commission in Port Vila is part of that strategy. And last week, a Royal Navy ship docked in the city as well. At the same time, the UK's Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, was touring through the region. For his part, Mr. Kausikau says the stoush has been resolved and it has not affected relations with the UK.
I've met with the High Commissioner of the United Kingdom, and we've actually resolved some of these issues, and we've decided to move away quickly from something that happened to be leaked to the media and move forward to forging stronger ties.
Vanuatu Prime Minister Ismail Kausikau ending that report from Liam Fox. Now for a look at some of the big stories in the region, I'm joined by Priyanka Srinivasan, the presenter for Pacific Beat. Priyanka, let's start in Papua New Guinea, where US President Joe Biden is expected to travel there next month. What do we know about this trip?
What we understand, at least, is that he's expected to stop by PNG, and that's after the G7 meeting in Japan, and just before the Quad leaders meeting in Australia as well. So that puts the date at around late May. And now it's the first visit, if it does happen, by a U.S. sitting president to the Pacific in recent history, apart from U.S. territories in the region. Now, it's all happening when the U.S. is really ramping up its presence in the region. We had, of course, Evan, that recent visit of the U.S. Asia-Pacific diplomat, Kirk Campbell. He was there around the time announcing the opening of various embassies in the region, including Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, to name a couple. And it's also at a time that Papua New Guinea itself is negotiating a United States defense cooperation agreement. Those negotiations have been ongoing, and we expect them to continue between Joe Biden and his counterpart in Papua New Guinea if he does make that visit. We also know that it has been confirmed that the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, will also be in PNG meeting with Pacific leaders at the same time. I mean, it is important to note that we expect this meeting not just to be between Papua New Guinean diplomats and Joe Biden, but also a number of other Pacific leaders who will also be part of discussions there in Papua New Guinea. But it is important to note that the details of this trip have not been fully locked in yet, though we do expect to happen, as I said, late in May. That's next month. So exciting times ahead.
Now, staying in PNG, authorities there are defending the death of 16 prison escapees. What have they said?
Yes, that's right. Well, to give us a bit of background on this incident at first, Evan, so it's to do with these 24 prisoners who fled a high-security facility in West New Britain in Papua New Guinea. Now, of those 24, 16 were shot dead, one was injured, and seven still, authorities say, are on the loose, as far as we know. Now, of those 16 that were shot, we understand, by prison guards, there are questions surrounding those killings. Now, Corrections Commissioner Stephen Pokanis did say those shootings were quite shocking. But he did also say there was a rising problem of inmates breaking out of prison. He said this is not unusual to have not only these prison breaks, but also these killings as a result of these breaks. Let's have a listen to a bit of what he had to say.
We have never seen any prisoners surrendering when we call to them to stop from escaping. The moment they leave the prison or when they are out of the outer fences, perimeter fences, no one has ever stopped and coming back and said, sorry, sir, I'm really sorry for following this others who have escaped. The normal protocol of issuing warnings, we normally do that. We do not just go and randomly shoot prisoners.
And that's Corrections Commissioner Stephen Pokanis speaking there. Now, Priyanka, let's head over to American Samoa, where there is a measles outbreak. What's the latest happening there?
So there are at least two confirmed cases now in American Samoa of measles and more than 40 suspected cases. Analyses of those suspected cases are still underway. Authorities say they have to send those tests overseas to get them tested before they can confirm whether they're negative or positive. And now the government has called a state of emergency as a result of those cases and suspected cases. It is now running an extensive vaccination campaign to make sure people are getting their shots and are therefore protected from the illness, from measles. And also, the government has moved fast to close down schools and daycare centres soon after that first case was identified. They're doing that to limit transmission. They're particularly focusing on younger children, so elementary schools, daycare centres, kindergartens, things like that have been closed down during the state of emergency. And we need to remember, you know, why the government might be moving this fast. And that is in part due to the fact that just 4 years ago, neighboring Samoa had, of course, you might remember, Evan, that deadly measles outbreak where there were more than 80 deaths, mostly of children there. That led to a similar ramping up of a vaccination campaign and something of a lockdown where many schools and daycare centers were also closed. So authorities there have said that that's, you know, in their minds. We spoke to American Samoa's territorial epidemiologist, Scott Inesi. He said, in fact, that a disruption in the vaccination schedule for children during the pandemic might be contributing to the rapid spread of measles there. Let's take a listen.
We started the first round of closing the early childhood education centers as well as the child daycare centers. We are now moving into all of the elementary schools, closing them and wrapping up our mass vaccination campaign. At the moment, because it goes through the government, the government declaration, the tentative date for reopening is May 12th. However, we are hoping that if we continue to do the mass vaccination campaigns, as well as isolating of probable cases at home, that we'll be able to stem the transmission in the community and be able to have a mechanism of reopening. So one of the mechanisms of reopening the schools is the vaccination rates in the community. As such, all schools are required by law to check the vaccination status of all the children that are enrolled in schools above grade one. Right now, we've closed all the elementary schools as we have a targeted population of those that may need their immunization. So the target is to fully immunize all school-age children above the age of one for the schools to reopen, as well as we're providing boosters to the adult staff. Now, the recommendations for the younger children is a little bit different, because during an outbreak, one of the CDC recommendations is to lower the age of the first dose to 6 months.
That was American Samoa's territorial epidemiologist, Scott Anesi, who spoke to me earlier. And since speaking to him, Samoa, neighboring Samoa, has also introduced its own broader restrictions with American Samoa. It's now requiring vaccination of all people, all visitors from American Samoa in entering the country who are aged above 6 months. That's at least one shot for the younger cohort and at least two shots of the measles vaccine for anyone older. Again, in an attempt to limit the spread of this very deadly virus.
That was Priyanka Srinivasan, host of the ABC's Pacific Beat program. Now, staying in Papua New Guinea, where a WhatsApp group is helping midwives in some of the country's most remote areas stay connected and get access to crucial advice. A PNG midwife currently studying in Australia came up with the idea, and as Dubravka Volodare reports, there's hope the initiative can help reduce PNG's high maternal and infant death rate.
Junior midwife Caroline Fred knows how crucial it is to reflect with others on patient care. But as the only midwife in her remote clinic in Bougainville, it can be hard to do so. The 29-year-old says having an app-based community of midwives from all over PNG has been invaluable for her.
Working in a remote facility, it's helped me to connect with other midwives.
Having graduated only late last year, Ms. Fred says she can now ask questions and get advice from other midwives. Behind the idea is Sherilyn Polliman. The idea to set up a support community for midwives using an instant messaging app came to her when she observed her environment.
The phone is always on our hands every day, every time. It will be used whenever we have the phone with us.
The 46-year-old says she had the idea after another non-phone-based support community she was running for midwives had a low uptake. But she saw the need for such a group because she knew that working as a midwife in remote parts can be isolating.
Seeing that we cannot swim alone, we need people to be around us. We need people to work with and having that connection.
Ms. Polliman contacted midwives across PNG to join the project. She made them administrators so they could also add new members. The members soon multiplied, and she says the community has now grown to about 500 across PNG and overseas.
So this community of practice is created in a way where there are discussions that I post, and the discussions are meant for the staff to read and discuss critically, and also, you know, share experiences that are related to the discussions.
Papua New Guinea has one of the highest rate of maternal and newborn deaths in the Pacific region. Estimates vary, but according to the World Bank, 34 babies in every 1,000 have died in childbirth in PNG in 2021. A research fellow at the ANU, Dr. Colin Wiltshire, says Papua New Guinea is among the hardest places in the world to give birth.
Expecting mothers find it often very difficult to access a skilled healthcare worker who can assist them the delivery and births. You know, most of the population, at least 85%, live in rural and remote locations. Those expecting mothers need to be able to access a health facility that would have a midwife available to deliver births.
He says midwives and mothers need all the support they can get.
Midwives and health workers at various levels of the health system have to refer expecting mothers to higher levels of the health system if they do experience difficulties. It's very hard for them to access, you know, things like basic transport, ambulances, emergency planes, you know, if they're needed to be able to, you know, deal with a you know, an emergency situation when mothers give birth. So mostly midwives are seeking greater support.
He says using phone-based services to connect midwives is a great idea. Sherilyn Polliman is happy that the app community is helping to address some of these problems.
We really don't communicate and attach to our rural midwives. We only see patients that are referred to us, to the hospital by the rural midwives. But with this group, I've seen that it connected the rural midwife, and even a junior rural midwife can easily get onto the phone and text and ask for advice.
The information sharing has also been invaluable for another member, Rondi Kutumsi. The 53-year-old is on study leave, but has worked as a midwife in health centres in East Sepik province for about 20 years. Despite her expertise, she has learned a lot from the community, including tips for delivering babies when things go wrong. Another recent topic of discussion she took part in was newborn care.
We learn from the discussion, especially when you deliver a baby, the baby has to have this bonding of a mother to baby. It must be kept on the chest of the mother for an hour, and then later you can do the other stuff like weighing babies and giving the newborn injections and all this.
That wasn't done before, would you say?
We do it, but we tend to forget, so we were emphasizing again. sewing videos and all this.
Sherilyn Polamon has big ideas for the group's future.
What I'm thinking of is to see that community grow or practice grow, and it kind of influences the way we think and we see ourselves, that we can always make difference when we stand together for our women.
More online discussion groups are already in the works.
That story by Dubravka Volodya and additional reporting from Hugo Hodge.
Pacific Beat.
Is it appropriate to spend aid money on a sporting event? That's the question being asked about Australia's $17 million contribution to help Solomon Islands host the Pacific Games later this year. Critics say the development benefits are questionable, and the real motive behind the grant is to counter China's involvement. Liam Fox with more.
$17 million might not sound like much money in the context of Australia's $4.6 billion aid budget. But Professor Stephen Howes, Director of the Development Policy Centre, believes it is, as it represents more than 16% of Australia's $100 million aid program to Solomon Islands this financial year. He says it's also comparable to the money Australia has provided to the responses to recent humanitarian crises.
It's a significant amount of money compared to the amount of money we've contributed to, you know, to real crisis situations. So think about the massive floods in Pakistan. We've only provided $10 million. Think about the Turkey-Syria earthquake. You know, where 41,000 people died and 1.5 million people are homeless. And we gave about the same amount, $18 million, as we're giving to the Pacific Island Games.
Perhaps more importantly, he says the grant breaks internationally accepted rules that exclude funding for sporting events from being considered as aid.
You know, we often make the case that the international order should be rules-based. So here's a clear example where we could put that into practice and where it looks like we're not. And that's just going to cause sort of cynicism about Australia's position in general.
Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says the money will be used to fund seven positions for Solomon's sporting officials, refurbished dormitories at six schools to house visiting athletes, sporting equipment for the National Institute of Sport, and construct a temporary marine centre for water sports. In response to questions from Professor Howes, the department said the funding is linked to activities that will not only benefit the Games, but will also deliver longer-term social benefits, including for young Solomon Islanders. He says that may be the case for money spent on dormitories and sporting equipment, but not for sporting officials or a temporary marine centre. The real motivation, he believes, is to counter China, which is providing around $100 million to build the Games' main stadium in Honiara.
There's no doubt we're doing it because China's doing it. It's a sign of the risks that we face if we really reorient our aid program, you know, to be used in a kind of strategic competition with China, that we're going to face these issues around sort of skirting around the rules, and that we're going to end up responding to low-priority causes.
Mark Purcell from the Australian Council for International Development says sports development is a legitimate area for aid funding.
The public health benefits of having your population engaged in sport, and indeed there are many active programs targeting young women to get them involved in sport. It has benefits not just in health but also in leadership skills.
But Mr. Purcell sees the funding for the Pacific Games as more of an infrastructure project, one clearly aimed at countering China's involvement. All of which is understandable, if not desirable, he says, in the current geostrategic environment. But it leaves Australia playing catch-up rather than focusing on its development strengths.
And that would be investment in long-term human capital, in health and education, agricultural resilience and tackling climate change. That's where Australia can make a difference. That's where we have runs on the board. And frankly, that's not an area that China can compete on in the Solomon Islands or anywhere else in the Pacific at this point in time.
Mark Purcell from the Australian Centre for International Development, ending that report from Liam Fox. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the region.